Good morning. I'm going to call this meeting of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency Advisory Planning Commission to order. It is Wednesday, November 10th, 2021. It's 9:31, and we're here yet again in our virtual webinar. The first item on the agenda is to call the roll to determine our quorum. So Tracy, could you please help me with that?
Mr. Oling?
Present.
Mr. Booth? Ms. Carr?
Present.
Ms. Chandler?
Present.
Mr. Drake?
Here.
Mr. Drew?
Good morning.
Mr. Ferry?
Present.
Ms. Sullivan? Mr. Gavon?
Present.
Mr. Hill?
Good morning.
Ms. Jacobson?
Here.
Mr. Hitchcock?
Here.
Ms. Simon?
Here.
Ms. Stala?
Here.
Mr. Teixeira?
Good morning.
Mr. Smokey? Mr. Young?
Good morning.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Great. Thank you, Tracy, for that. Welcome to everyone. I will now go over the meeting rules for the day, so bear with me for a moment here. To observe the meeting, go to trpa.gov. Under the calendar header, click on the Advisory Planning Commission online meeting for November 10, 2021. There you'll find a link to the public webinar hosted on GoToWebinar. To address APC members directly with your comments, please utilize the hand-raising function in the control panel of the GoToWebinar, which you should see under the red microphone. At the appropriate time for public comments, please raise your hand by clicking on the hand icon, and a TRPA staff member will unmute you and indicate that you can begin your public comment. Please state your name. If you requested a reasonable accommodation from TRPA and have been provided a unique PIN number for dial-in, you'll be unmuted at the time you requested to make your public comment. If you are using GoToWebinar's Instant Join web app, please make sure it's open in the Google Chrome browser and that you allow access to your microphone in order to be unmuted. Finally, if you have called into the general attendee line with the access code posted on the website, please be aware this is a listen-only option. To APC members, if you wish to speak, you can alert me via the chat function or speak up when someone else isn't speaking. For APC members, please only use the chat function to indicate a desire to speak. This function must not be used to have a sidebar conversation. Remember to mute your mic unless you'd like a hot mic moment. And as I mentioned earlier, please turn on your cameras as we now have sufficient capacity on our platform to accommodate all members, which is great. Thank you, TRPA. So now I'll move on to item two, which is approval of the agenda. Staff, do we have any changes to the agenda?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. This is Kim Carringer. I'm filling in for John Hester today. We do not have changes to the agenda.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I will deem the agenda approved as it's posted for the record and go on to item three. Bear with me again here. This is on public interest comments. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission, please use the hand-raising function now, and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. All public comments should be as brief and concise as possible so that all who wish to participate may do so. The chair has the discretion to set appropriate time allotments for individual speakers. No extra time for participants will be permitted by ceding time of others. Written comments received prior to the meeting were forwarded to the APC members. I did not see any for this meeting. In the interest of efficient meeting management, the chairperson reserves the right to limit the duration of each public comment period to a total of 1 hour. Any unheard public comments can be submitted via email to tcampbell@trpa.gov. They'll be forwarded to all APC members. Please note that the Advisory Planning Commission is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public that are not listed on the agenda. Now I will turn this over to Catherine to manage muting and unmuting members of the public with raised hands.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay, thank you, Catherine. I'll move us on to item 4, which is disposition of minutes. We have a set of minutes in the agenda packet from July 14, 2021. It's on page 7. Do any APC members have questions, comments, corrections on the minutes? Please speak up.
I do, Mr. Chair.
Steve.
I just 3 very minor ones. On page 4, fourth paragraph down, second to the last sentence in that paragraph, it should say which have lower trip rates as opposed to trick. And on page 12, there are 2 in the second paragraph, third line down, then the boat, not bulk. And then in the 5th paragraph down, I believe, it's local boaters, not voters. But I offer these changes in full respect of the great work that Tracy Campbell does on the minutes. She really does a terrific job.
I second that. Good catches, Steve. Tracy, were you able to get those?
I got those, yeah. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
Hearing none of my colleagues with any additional changes, I will offer a motion to approve the minutes of July 14th meeting as amended.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Susan. I'll second that.
Thank you, Susan. Okay, we do not need a roll call vote on this, so please unmute. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Anyone aye. Object? Any abstentions?
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is Kevin Hill. I'd like to abstain from voting on the minutes.
Thank you, Kevin. Okay, I believe we are all set with item 4. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, this is Jason Drew. I abstain as well. I was not at the meeting in July.
Thank you, Jason.
I guess I will abstain as well then. I'll join the crowd.
Is that Judith?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Did you get all those, Tracy?
Got them. Yes. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you all. I'll move us on to item 5, planning matters. Item 5A is an update on the Tahoe Living, Housing, and Community Revitalization Working Group. Number 1, we'll get a briefing from the Tahoe Living, Housing, and Community Revitalization Working Group. 2, we will appoint the Advisory Planning Commission Washoe County lay member to the Tahoe Living, Housing, and Community Revitalization Working Group. Information on this item can be found on page 19 of your packet. And I'm now going to turn this over to Karen Fink to present on this item. Hi, Karen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Advisory Planning Commission. So, my colleague Alyssa Bettinger and I are very excited to present to you this morning on the progress of the Tahoe Living Strategic Initiative and the Tahoe Living Working Group. We're going to bring you up to speed on what's happened since we last presented to you in July, and we'll go over what we're going to be tackling next with the working group. And we also want to talk about how we are incorporating some of your input that we heard at the APC meeting in July into this next phase. Next slide, please. So in July, we brought forward a package of housing amendments, and the APC made a recommendation of approval of these amendments to the governing board. Later in July, the governing board approved these amendments as recommended by the APC with one exception, and I'm going to go over that now. So there were 3 elements of this housing amendment. The first one was modifying the bonus unit boundary. That's where we allow our deed-restricted bonus units to be distributed. So modifying the bonus unit boundary to be consistent with some recent planning efforts. and the governing board approved that. Similarly, the governing board also approved the amendment to allow non-conforming tourist density used on site for residential density during redevelopment. The other element of the package of housing amendments was related to allowing more flexibility for accessory dwelling units. And two key elements of that proposal was to allow accessory dwelling units on parcels of less than one, residential parcels of less than 1 acre region wide, and also to allow up to two accessory dwelling units per parcel, to allow for one attached and one detached accessory dwelling unit. And the governing board approved that amendment for the California side only. They held off on approving it for the Nevada side based on concerns that there aren't the same restrictions related to use of accessory dwelling units as short-term rentals on the Nevada side as there are on the California side. So they requested that Washoe County and Douglas County come back to the local government and housing committee with a specific recommendation of how they'd like to handle accessory dwelling units, and then ask the Tahoe Living Working Group to revisit that issue on the Nevada side at that time. So these amendments went into effect September 29th. We've already started receiving ADU applications under the new amendments, and we've also received several inquiries from property owners who have tourist development about using the non-conforming tourist density amendment. So it's really exciting to see these changes get used right away. Next slide, please. So now that we completed that first phase, we started moving into the next phase, and we met with the Tahoe Living Working Group on October 28th. And many of the APC members sit on that working group, so they were at the meeting. And as we're getting started on the next phase, we just kind of wanted to review with the group what's the overall housing targets that we're working towards with these, you know, proposed amendments. So there's two buckets of housing need that we've identified with the group. The first in that middle column is the minimum need that we're working toward, and that is based on the California RENA requirements. The state of California requires the California jurisdictions to show in their housing elements that they can provide a certain amount of housing. And so that's this minimum need that we're working toward. It's about 1,000 housing units, and it's on the California side only. There's also what we're calling the optimal need, and that is based on housing assessments that have been completed by the Tahoe Prosperity Center and the Mountain Housing Council. And that provides a more regional picture of the overall housing need for the Tahoe Basin. That's about 4,500 housing units, and that's in that right-hand column. And you'll see here that this number has actually been kind of rounded out by the Washoe County housing need. Washoe County recently partnered with the Tahoe Prosperity Center to complete a housing needs report for the Washoe County portion of Tahoe Basin. So now we have that missing piece of the housing need and a full regional picture. And this housing, both of these housing needs are geared towards the year 2026. Next slide, please. So as we start working toward that need, we also wanted to review some of the progress that's been made on the ground with providing actual units. So this slide shows new affordable and workforce housing units that have either been constructed since the working group started meeting in August 2020 or have received their permits. So you can see about 100 units have been constructed or been made operational through the Home Key program, and about another 300 units have received their permits. So, just comparing to that overall need, it's getting a pretty significant portion of the way towards that minimal housing need, and it's about 10% of the way towards the more regional optimal need. And these units are all on the California side. And then this gives a picture of sort of that tangible new construct units on the ground. I also just wanted to mention that there's been a strong focus at the local level in recent months on really encouraging getting existing housing stock back into the local rental market. So Placer County and the city of South Lake Tahoe in particular have both been working on some new incentives to better utilize that existing housing stock. And that's a really important piece of the puzzle as well. Next slide, please. So now as we're getting into the next phase, we're working through the set of priority housing actions that the working group identified as sort of the most important things that TRPA could do to get more units on the affordable and workforce categories and also to reduce the cost of affordable housing. And they're prioritized based on which actions are likely to have the biggest impact. So we've been working in the near term set there, that first row, ADUs, small homes, and density. And we're going to continue to finish out those items, although we're starting to overlap with some of the later actions in this table. Next slide, please. So here's just a little more detail about what we're going to be working on with the working group moving into 2022. So over here on the right, we're going to be focusing on density, height and coverage, and really looking at that overall building envelope and how, do TRPA, are there ways that our regulations can better encourage affordable and workforce housing through those regulations? We're calling that intensity, density, and dimensional standards. And Alyssa's going to go into a little more detail on what we've already worked on related to that and input that we received from the working group. And then also at the same time, we're going to finish out some work that still needs to be done related to incentivizing accessory dwelling units and small homes. So one thing we want to keep working on, we started this in phase one, but we didn't complete it, is really tightening up the language for our achievable deed restrictions to make sure that that achievable deed restriction is really targeted towards our workforce. And then the other thing we want to look at is in large part based on input that we heard at the APC meeting in July, and that was concern over the fact that TRPA's development rights system requires the same development right for a very small junior ADU that's within the footprint of an existing house as it requires for a large 6 or even 10 bedroom house. And that's really seen as a barrier to the private market providing workforce and affordable housing. So we're going to look at that in this next phase as well. And now I'm going to turn it over to Alyssa for some more detail on the intensity, density, and dimensional standards.
Great. Thanks, Karen. And Tracy, you can go to the next slide. One of the next main focuses of the housing initiative will be on the development standards like density, height, and coverage. And oftentimes planners refer to these standards as intensity, density, and dimensional standards. So we're trying to keep with these terms. In Tahoe, these standards generally fit within the 5 growth management strategies that were put into place between 1972 and 1987. And while these standards are generally fundamental to achieving TRPA's thresholds, oftentimes they can prevent the type of development that we want to see. And so we've spent the past couple of months examining these regulations, specifically looking at height and density, really trying to determine in which cases these standards are serving to achieve these thresholds or our thresholds, and where they are inadvertently incentivizing larger homes and disincentivizing the type of housing that we want to see. And our thinking here has really evolved. And as I mentioned, originally we were planning to just look at height and density kind of first. And this was because we found specifically with density that it could have a significant cost reduction for larger multifamily development. But through discussions with the working group, we realized that we really can't look at just height and density alone. And so going forward, we'll look at height, density, and coverage. These slides are a summary of what we presented to the working group on October 28th. And then at the end, I'll summarize some of the input that we did hear from the working group and how it will influence our work moving forward. Next slide, please. One of the goals we've heard from the working group and the public is to provide options for more flexibility within the building envelope. And I know that the building envelope is the term that some of you are very familiar with, but others may not be. And so when we talk about the building envelope, we're really referring to the amount of area that can be used for the living space. And kind of in the simplest way, this is the amount of allowable coverage multiplied by the height and then reduced by the amount of parking or other impervious coverage that would be used kind of away from the living area. And this concept, I think, is really why we need to look at all of these standards together, because they definitely influence each other and ultimately what gets built. Next slide, please. We've heard from a number of our working group members that the problem is not specific or is specific to the parcel, and it's not always the same. And so just to kind of quickly highlight what I'm talking about, on some sites, existing densities are too low. And so developers will build out the maximum size unit when potentially more units could fit within the building envelope if they were allowed. So if you can only have two units maximum on a parcel based on the allowable density, but your building envelope is actually larger and could fit more units, you end up with, you know, less larger units. And then on the other hand, sometimes height or coverage restricts the total building envelope that you can have. So you have kind of the opposite problem where you actually can't build to the number of allowed units or allowed density per acre because they won't actually fit within the building envelope. And then we also realize that oftentimes it's a combination of density, height, and coverage and potentially other standards that drive builders to construct larger units that are not usually occupied by our local residents. Next slide, please. And over the past few months, we've, as we were focusing primarily on height and density, we were looking to other communities to see how they were incentivizing workforce housing. And we found that generally, jurisdictions have applied a number of different strategies to achieve a very similar goal in getting more missing middle or workforce housing units on the ground. I've highlighted two examples from Portland and Santa Barbara on this slide here. In Portland, the city incentivizes building more units by allowing more coverage and less parking allowances if there is more than one unit being built on a lot. And then in Santa Barbara, they've taken a slightly different approach and implemented a maximum unit size program that works in combination with density for specific zones throughout the city. And this program is optional in Santa Barbara, but developers who utilize it, they also are incentivized because they can build to higher density than what is normally allowed. And they also receive flexibility with parking, open space, and setback requirements. Next slide, please. So we did want to just quickly highlight some of the takeaways from our working group meeting on October 28th. We presented some conceptual options, again, specifically related to height and density. But the overwhelming takeaway from the meeting was that development standards, again, need to be looked at holistically, and that coverage really should be considered along with height and density options. The working group members suggested that we put together a few packages of alternatives for these standards. And so again, we've adjusted our approach to look at kind of these three key standards. And then within these packages, we'll look at a range of alternative options. On one hand, one package could include some of the more low-hanging fruit options. And these are things that generally could be changed or tweaked within our existing processes to help move the needle on getting the type of housing that we want to see. And an example of this is looking at where we already allow up to 70% coverage in our town centers and looking at potentially where this could be expanded to certain areas and connecting that with our BMP program. On the other side of things, we'll also be looking at system level changes that could really take quite a bit longer and require more analysis, but potentially have a larger impact. An example that came out of the working group meeting was potentially TRPA could allow additional flexibility with density if local jurisdictions implemented a form-based code. Again, that's not that's something that we'll consider in the next phase. That's not something that we're bringing set in stone forward at this point. And then lastly, there was some interest in testing some of these changes out in specific areas for a certain amount of time through a pilot program. And pilot programs have been used quite a few times in Tahoe and have been pretty successful elsewhere. So that might be something that we'll consider with these alternatives and generally that working group members were supportive of. Next slide. So just to quickly touch on next steps, we are anticipating that we'll bring back these conceptual alternative packages to our Tahoe Living Working Group this winter. Based on the feedback that we receive at that meeting, we're targeting the spring Tahoe Living Working Group meeting to bring back more specific policy and potentially code recommendations if we're at that point. That would bring us to next summer, bringing forward these code recommendations through the approval process. But I do want to just note that this timeline is probably more realistic of some of those simpler code changes, and that the larger system level changes could take longer. So this timeline could generally change, but this is what we're targeting at this point. And I think with that, I will turn it back over to Karen.
I will turn it back over to Brendan to see if there's any questions.
All right. Thank you, Karen and Alyssa. That was a great summary of a lot of complicated work and interaction with the public and an extensive working group that we have. That was great. I know a few of the APC members were in attendance at the last meeting and are on the working group, so you're much more familiar with this process than others. I'd encourage, you know, both groups to weigh in here if you have questions or comments for those that haven't heard about this, or if you have insights from participating in the meeting that you haven't shared, that weren't shared, and you want to raise those, I think that would be great. So why don't I go ahead and open this up to APC members? Any questions, comments? Why don't you go ahead and unmute and speak up? You're on mute. If anyone's talking.
Hi, Brendan. I have a comment, if I may. Hi.
Yeah.
So thank you for the information. I know this is a long process and a really good topic to tackle. I like hearing the update and seeing how comments from the APC have been incorporated. And I know that coverage really hasn't been tackled just yet. You guys are now really in the process of doing that. And I think in addition to considering coverage in terms of using it as a way to incentivize affordable housing or the type of housing we want to see, I think it's also important to consider how potential changes to the code of ordinances could impact the Nevada Land Bank or possibly the CTC's California side land bank, because there are also economic factors at play, not just planning considerations. And I noticed too on the roster that there are, in addition to working group members, there are staff from various agencies who also participate, and we would be happy to participate in future meetings.
Thank you. That would be great. We can keep you posted on those meetings.
Yeah, agreed. Thanks, Ellery. Other comments or questions?
I have one, Mr. Chair.
Steve.
No, it strikes me, of course, in reading the minutes of our July 14th meeting, it was a very good detailed summary of the comments that were made by APC members of the public, And I'm wondering if it might not be helpful, Karen, if members of the APC, as they look at these issues, could see the minutes of like RPIC meetings or governing board meetings where these items are discussed. I think that might sort of round out our overall understanding of what different parts of the TRPA decision-making matrix, what they're thinking about this. I always find that really helps me to understand what different people are saying. So rather than just seeing our own minutes, maybe we could see the minutes of others. Just a thought.
Yeah, good thought, Steve. I don't know, mechanically, is there a way for us to do that? Karen, or?
This is Tracy, Brendan. I can certainly work with Karen to find links for those minutes and ensure that they're forwarded to the APC members by email.
Okay.
That would be great. Thank you.
Yeah, and we could also highlight in our presentation too some of the key points made by the other committees.
Mm-hmm. It's such a complex set of issues that I think getting a lot of perspectives, including members of the RPIC governing board, et cetera, would really help our overall understanding, because the goal ultimately is to come up with some things that can pass through the process, through our groups, and then on to RPIC and the governing board. So understanding some of the questions that they're asking, I think, would really be helpful when we think about what is the end result here that we're looking for.
Hello, yeah, Brendan. This is Eric from Washoe County.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
I really appreciate taking part on this working group. Karen does a great job. It's really complex and important, as you mentioned. She does a great job telling you what we're up to, but so I don't feel like I really need to chime in much on that. I think the thing I'll chime in on is kind of what happened at the last meeting and where the meetings have been going is a lot of the working group is really struggling to find a way to question the entire development rights regime. A lot of them don't quite understand it. They know it's important. They know they have to deal with it. They want to ask questions about it. They want to change it. They want to say this isn't working for us, but it's very difficult for many of the members to articulate that, to find ways to articulate it that aren't distressing or upsetting, or to even really just come out and say, I don't get this. But that's a kind of an under the surface thing that's been dwelling, and it started to kind of come up at the last meeting where people are really starting to have a very robust, complex discussion about, look how all of these things fit together. And when you're putting all of these things together, look how at odds it is with the other policies that you're trying to achieve. So it's looking to us out here in the world that TRPA is kind of working at cross ends to itself in some ways. And that's, I don't want to speak for everybody. I'm certainly not even speaking for myself right now. I'm kind of speaking for an observation that I see across the group of trying to begin a discussion about, look at how this development rights regime may actually be working against us achieving some of TRPA's other stated goals and policies. And so it's just the beginning of the discussion, and I think a lot of people are even having a little bit of a hard time knowing exactly how to bring it up and exactly how to begin talking about it. But I feel like it definitely kind of started at the last meeting. And so that's, of all the things to bring up, I think that might be the most important thing to bring up about what's beginning to come out of this working group. And Karen, please, if you feel that none of that's what you heard or you didn't observe any of that, please just counter me on that. But I feel like that's kind of what I observed at this last meeting. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Eric. Karen, do you want to weigh in on that? Or?
No, I appreciate the comment, and I think that's right. Our development rights system is, pretty complicated. And so maybe a good place to start is also just, you know, kicking off this next discussion, some basic background on how development rights actually work so that everybody can be starting from the same place as we move into, you know, modifications that will help us better meet our goals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
May I just one last thing. I apologize for jumping again. It was also important at a few points in the last meeting that we had to make sure everybody understands how far away from a simple environmental mandate TRPA has moved. And the broad, comprehensive planning, social, economic, and environmental mandate that TRPA has throughout the basin. And we should all be beyond having to have that discussion. We should all understand that place of TRPA in the basin now. But I think when any of us who have a role on one of the boards, an official role with TRPA, hears comments about TRPA doesn't really have any business talking about something because it's really just an environmental organization. We need to speak up immediately about those comments and make sure everybody is on board with the real mandate of TRPA, because those comments are very they're disruptive and they're not helpful, and that needs to be educated out of anybody who doesn't understand it as quickly as possible when we hear those comments. So that's the last thing I'll have to say today. Thank you.
I appreciate that, Eric. I'm sure TRPA staff does too. I mean, TRPA is evolving and, you know, taking on these big issues and listening to stakeholders like us and the public and others, developers. So I couldn't agree more with that. I'm glad you said it. So thanks.
Yeah, and if I add on to that, I think Eric's comment was based on a comment that came up at the working group. And John Hester did clarify at that meeting that the TRPA compact does go beyond just strictly environmental regulations and also calls for TRPA to look at the economic and social impacts of regulations and actions in the basin as well.
Right. Great. Other APC members? Okay. Hearing none, why don't I move us along to public comment on this item? So again, to participate in the meeting, go to trpa.gov. In the calendar, click on Advisory Planning Commission meeting, November 10, 2021. There you'll find a link to the public webinar. If any member of the public wishes to address the Advisory Planning Commission on this item, please use the hand-raising function now and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. Catherine, I'm going to turn this over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay. Thank you, Catherine. I'll go ahead and close public comment, and I will provide one last call for APC members.
Yeah, Brendan, this is Crystal Jacobson.
Hey, Crystal.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that I really appreciate the presentation. One of the areas that we are very interested in kind of looking at, you know, potential opportunities for revision would be related to coverage in town centers. We recently had a project that came in for workforce housing in our town center. So sort of, you know, had the height and density allowances to really get a really good, you know, dense affordable housing project on the ground, but coverage became the problem. So I'm excited to see that coverage, you know, is part of this next phase for, you know, exploring options for revision or just consideration. So really appreciate the presentation, Karen, and I know our team has been working with you on this next phase. So excited to see what comes of it.
Thanks, Crystal. Yeah, coverage kept coming up at the last meeting. And I'm glad that TRPA, you know, embraced those comments and wants to take a hard look at it. So I think that's great. Any other members? Final thoughts?
Yeah, Brendan, this is John with the city. Just a couple thoughts. I spent a lot of time talking to you know, property owners that are interested in developing ADUs. And I think and I appreciate all the stuff that TRPA is doing, and we're slowly moving in the right direction. But I also want TRPA staff to think about the development right issue. You know, in order to build the ADU, you need the development right. And, you know, based on my experience, Dillon rights are, to find an actual development right to transfer to a property to build ADU is few, there's few out there that I'm aware of. And I know the CTC used to sell development rights, but my understanding is they don't have any at this point. But something to think about, because there are people who are interested in building ADUs, but are not interested in getting a bonus use from TRPA because there's a deed restriction associated with it. They rather just have an ADU and build it for whether it's you know, for grandparents or a relative to live in without having that deed restriction burden on the property. And like yesterday, I talked with an individual and trying to explain to her what she had to go through to build an ADU. And you know, and her question was, well, where do I go find a development right? And that's a tough question. It's hard to answer that question because there's not many out there. But something to think about as you move forward with this program. Thanks.
Thanks, Edge. Any other final thoughts?
Just, Mr. Chairman, wanted to thank John for bringing that forward. That's a reality that when we're thinking about all these commodities, we don't always remember that some of them are pretty scarce, if not non-existent.
Yep. Okay. Thank you all. Thank you so much, Karen and Alyssa, for coming to present to us today. We appreciate it, and we look forward to the next working group meeting and moving this ball forward. So.
Thank you.
All right. Let me see where we are here. Oh, yeah. We have to go on to part two of this item. Sorry. Lost my place. Part two of this item requires a motion. So, Karen, I think I'm going to turn this back to you, actually, on the appointment of the Washoe County lay member to the working group.
Thank you. Yeah, I just have a quick explanation of this item. So we are requesting that the APC take one more action today, and that is to appoint Judith Simon in her role as the Washoe County lay member to the APC, or sorry, to the Tahoe Living Housing and Community Revitalization Working Group. So previously the APC had appointed Tim Calicrate to the working group, but Tim has since left the APC and also vacated his position on the working group. So we really want to keep that balance of Nevada and California representation and also North-South representation on the working group. So after consultation with Washoe County Commissioner Alexis Hill and also Ms. Simon herself, we wanted to recommend that the Washoe County lay member position be permanently appointed to the working group. And Ms. Simon participated in our working group meeting on October 28th and really appreciative of her input and look forward to continuing to work with her. So we have the motion up here on the screen, and then we also have the slides for working group questions, comments, and public comment.
Thanks, Karen. Any questions or comments from APC members on that?
This is John Marshall. I'd just like to clarify that this motion is not directly related to Judy, but rather it's appointing the position. So should Judy vacate the position, the next person who comes into that position would automatically be on the working group. So we just wanted to make certain that while everyone knows at the present time it's Judy, that the intent here is to appoint the position so that if there's a future vacancy, we don't have to come back to you, essentially.
Thanks, John. All right. I think we're good. Anyone want to make that motion?
Eric Young, move to approve.
Is that good enough, John, or do we need to say the whole motion?
Eric, would you just mind reading the motion?
Not at all, John. Happy to. I'd like to make a motion to appoint a Washoe County lay member of the Advisory Planning Commission or their designee to the Tahoe Living, Housing, and Community Revitalization Working Group.
Thank you, Aaron. Eric, anyone want to second that?
This is Ellery. I'll second that motion.
Okay, we had Steve. Steve jumped in first. I'm going to give it to Steve. And thank you very much for that motion and the second. So, Tracy, could you please do a roll call vote for us?
Ms. Chandler?
Approved, yeah, A.
Mr. Oling?
Yes.
Mr. Drake?
Yes.
Ms. Carr?
Yes.
Mr. Drew?
Yes.
Ms. Jacobson?
Yes.
Mr. Gavan?
Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Hitchcock? Oh,
sorry. Yes.
Thank you. Ms. Simon?
Am I in order to vote?
Yes, this is John. Yes, you can. It's for the position, not necessarily for you.
All right, thank you. Yes.
Ms. Stala?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Young?
Yes.
And Mr. Ferry?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, that motion passes.
Thank you, Tracy. Welcome, Washoe County, officially. And that concludes that item. Thank you again to everyone. I will move us on now to item 5B, which is an update on the Caldor fire recovery. Information on this item can be found on page 25 of your packet. And I'm going to pass this over to Shannon Friedman to present. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, APC members. It's nice to see so many familiar faces on the screen. I'm going to be giving an update on the Caldor fire, specifically the burn area emergency response plan and the watershed emergency response team plan and what's been going on with those and what's happening on the ground to date. The Caldor fire was determined to be 100% contained on October 21st, thanks to the great efforts of the Forest Service, Cal Fire, Lake Valley Fire Protection District, and all the other agencies and individuals who really supported those efforts to contain that fire, protect life and property. It's really, you know, quite amazing given the circumstances that we were under. Next slide, please. The three phases of fire recovery are fire suppression and repair, emergency stabilization, and long-term restoration. For the Caldor fire, we've transitioned into the second phase, which is implementing the emergency stabilization that's identified in the BEAR report, but still working on some fire suppression repair actions as well. Since there was a lot of work to protect life and property, there's then a lot of repair that needs to occur afterwards to protect resources and life and property to post-fire threats. Next phase, please. Next slide, please. So the fire was contained October 21st, and then Mother Nature was like, don't breathe, guys, because then right after that, we got like a record storm in South Lake Tahoe. I think we received about 6.37 inches of rain with snow at the higher elevations. So I know that El Dorado County residents, the city of South Lake Tahoe, were all working really hard leading up to that storm to protect their resources and property from the potential impacts of that storm. At TRPA, we were able to provide assistance. We were able to move some money around so El Dorado County could purchase a Vector truck to better maintain all of their storm drain infrastructure now and in the future. We also were able to help assist them in getting sand and sandbags to a property so private property owners could come and pick those up to protect their property from potential impacts to that storm. We also did a lot of work reaching out to private property owners, letting them know about potential risks and what they could do to mitigate those risks to protect their property from those impacts. Next slide, please. The states of Nevada and California were able to provide funding so the USGS could expand their stream monitoring. This allows us to get real-time stream data during all events. This is a screenshot of suspended sediment during the time frame of that October storm. You can see that during the peak of that storm, there was definitely a really high peak in suspended sediment. And this gauge is the Upper Truckee River at Highway 50. And so it spiked, as you would probably imagine. It's important to point out that then it did drop again pretty quickly. Looking at the data for the significant rain event that we received yesterday, it did spike again at the same location, but to a much lesser degree. The storm was a less significant storm. I think at Upper Truckee River, the peak was 800 CFS at this location in October, and yesterday it was 120 CFS. So the peaks in turbidity and suspended sediment kind of correlated to the CFS and rose, but then quickly dropped thereafter. There's a lot of interest with all members of the community on the impacts that this fire will have long-term on water quality in the Lake Tahoe Basin. Because of that, the Tahoe Science Advisory Council was able to provide money to some additional research proposals. Those include doing water and atmospheric sampling on ash and smoke impacts to water quality and air quality. We know a lot what suspended sediment and turbidity does to water quality, but there's not a lot of information out there about what those impacts of ash are and smoke on water quality. So it would be great to get that data. They also gave money to enhance turbidity monitoring and assessing the effectiveness of forest and fuels treatments on wildfires and its ability to help fight fires and how those treatments impact the fire's response on the landscape. Next slide, please. The Caldor Fire moved into the Tahoe Basin really, really quickly over Echo Summit under really undesirable conditions. I think we had three red flag warning days right as it was coming in over Echo Summit. And so because of that, Forest Service and Cal Fire, the Lake Valley Fire Protection District, they were really doing everything they could to protect property and life in the Tahoe Basin and throughout the fire area. So in Tahoe, because of that, there were 61 dozer lines constructed, 22 miles of hand lines constructed, and of those, there was 46 stream crossings. So there was a lot of fire suppression activity going on during the peak of this fire activity. And that's why they're actively out there still doing repair on the fire suppression to control erosion and protect water quality from those efforts. Next slide, please. This is just an example of some of the dozer lines and then the repair of those dozer lines. This example is the one on Angora Ridge in the old Angora burn scar. You can see that pretty big dozer line right there. And then on the right is that same dozer line after it has been repaired. You can see they smoothed out the grading that they did to build that dozer line and then put mulch and slash and debris across that to stabilize that slope and provide some surface roughness to protect it from erosion during a precipitation event post-fire. Next slide, please. This is another example of a dozer line and the restoration of that dozer line afterwards. This is, I believe this is off of South Upper Truckee neighborhood. And just same thing, showing an example of the good work they did restoring the dozer lines that they constructed during the fire. Next slide. The burned area emergency response plan summary report was released in late October. The objectives of that plan is to assess post-fire threats to human life, safety, and property, as well as to natural and cultural resources, and then identify actions that that can be taken to mitigate those risks. Right now, they are in the process of getting final approval from the forest supervisors on the BEAR report, while simultaneously implementing some of the recommendations that were identified in that plan to mitigate any threats post-fire. Next slide, please. One of the first things to come out of the BEAR report that is important to help identify and manage post-fire risks is the soil burn severity map. This image shows the fire as it burned in the Lake Tahoe Basin. You can see the upper, or the right side, I guess, is Echo Summit and US 50, and then you see the band that it burned across the landscape. It burned just under 10,000 acres of Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit land in the Tahoe Basin. And the good news is that in Tahoe, most of this burned at low to moderate severity, which is better than some of the areas of the Caldor Fire on the western slope that burned at a much higher severity. When looking at soil burn severity, they don't just look at the amount of vegetation was burned, but they really take a hard look at how much that soil burned and how deep that soil profile burned, because that is what's going to tell you how that landscape responds to precipitation post-fire and how much it will erode, what the threat of a major landslide or debris flow is. So they really look at what that soil looks like post-fire. Next slide. Another thing the BEAR report produces is they model erosion rates for different storm events. This is showing the whole Caldor Fire erosion rates for a five-year event. You can see that on the left side is the areas of the fire that burned much more severely. That's kind of the Grizzly Flat area that was really devastated by the fire, and that has a high erosion rate. And then on the right side, that green band is the portion that burned in the Tahoe Basin. And you can see there that the erosion rate is predicted to be pretty low. And that has to do with where it burned and that burn severity of the fire in the Tahoe Basin. Next slide. The treatments that were identified in the BEAR report include road stabilization, hazmat containment, burned area closure, trail stabilization, hazmat removal, road and storm drain inspection and response, considering the closure of recreation sites, and then invasive weed management post-fire. So all of these actions are currently either being implemented by Forest Service or will be implemented once the final BEAR report is approved by the forest supervisors. Next slide. The BEAR report focuses solely on federal lands. Oh, my apologies. My phone rang. The Watershed Emergency Response Team is a similar report that focuses on non-federal land. The WERT report is co-led by CAL FIRE and the California Geological Survey. Next slide. The WERT report, the final WERT report is still getting reviewed by the executives at those agencies, but a lot of the products that have come out of the report have already been released. So WERT comes into play when there has been a large fire across the landscape that poses a threat from post-fire debris flow, rockfall, or flooding to life, property, or natural or cultural resources. They have a systematic approach to go and analyze impacts across the landscape. It includes resource specialists such as hydrologists and botanists, and they work side by side with the BEAR team. They use the same reports, like the burn area severity map that was in the BEAR is also used in the WERT. So They're separate processes, but use the same report and really coordinated throughout the Caldor fire when they were producing their reports. The big difference is BEAR focusing on federal land and WERC focusing on non-federal land. Next slide. The WERC process first really determines the soil burn severity in conjunction with the BEAR team, and then models hazards and identifies values at risk. This is one of the most important pieces of information that comes out of the WERC process because it looks at values that are on non-federal land and which ones are at risk from flooding, landslide, debris flow, rockfall, post-fire. And then it identifies protective measures to help mitigate those risks and also comes up with a rainfall threshold determination. And what that does is it sets a level of rainfall where a debris flow could occur. So if you have over 5 inches of rain in this spot, your chance of a debris flow could be quite high. And they take all that information and communicate it with the public throughout the whole process, particularly to people who own property that is identified as a value at risk within the fire. Next slide. The WERC identified 74 values at risk throughout the whole Caldor fire. Those were primarily to residential structures, highway infrastructure, water system infrastructure, and water quality. In the Tahoe Basin, there were only 5 values at risk. 4 of those were considered low risk and 1 was moderate. Those were primarily to highway infrastructure, and I believe 1 was to a residential structure. Next slide. These are just some of the models that the WERC team uses to develop their maps and their predictions for erosion, debris flow, etc. Next slide. This is showing the potential debris flow throughout the whole Caldor fire. And similar to some of the other models that I've shared, the potential for debris flow is much higher on the western slope, kind of in that Grizzly Flat area. And the area in the Lake Tahoe Basin has a much lower to moderate risk of debris flow during a precipitation event. Next slide. In addition to the regular WERC report, the WERC team was also able to contract with the Rocky Mountain Research Station to run a watershed erosion prediction program run for the Caldor fire. There is a version of wet cloud that is calibrated for Lake Tahoe. So they ran this model, and this model predicts sediment yields across the landscape. Next slide. For Tahoe, it showed on a sub-watershed scale that the sediment yield within Trout Creek could be a factor increase of 2.2 over the pre-burn condition, and on the Upper Truckee River, 1.2. That seems really high, but I want to emphasize that this is on the sub-watershed scale, so that doesn't mean that there's going to be that increase of sediment yield into Lake Tahoe, because there's a lot of opportunity for that sediment to settle out before it reaches Lake Tahoe. Next slide. The wet cloud predicted that sediment yields to Lake Tahoe would increase less than 20%. And that has to do with where the fire burned on the landscape. As that one map showed, it kind of burned this band across the landscape, and it just burned a small, relatively small percentage through the Upper Truckee River and Trout Creek watersheds. And then it also has to flow through a lot of landscape before it gets to Lake Tahoe. And there's a lot of work that EIP partners have done throughout these watersheds on stream restoration, meadow restoration projects that we think will be advantageous in helping filter out those sediments before it gets to Lake Tahoe. Next slide. I believe we are going to try to show a video that shows how forest treatments impact fire and the ability to fight fire. So Tracy, is the video ready to go?
Looks like it was ready. We should be ready to go now. Bear with me one second.
Okay.
Welcome back to Forest News. In this episode, we'll look at how field treatment areas on National Forest System lands changed the intensity of the Caldor fire and allowed for community defense. But first, what's a field treatment area? A field treatment area is a location where the Forest Service or our partners have reduced or removed the amount of burnable material, specifically surface and ladder fuels. This can be completed by mechanical equipment or prescribed fire, or what we really like, a combination of both. It also includes ecological thinning, the removal of whole trees to increase crown spacing and reduce tree densities. The combination of these field treatments reduces the chance of a fire moving from the ground up through the shade-tolerant species and into the crowns of the trees. And if it does get up there, it further reduces the chance of a fire moving from crown to crown to crown and a high intensity fire. You can see in this field treatment area, there's not much surface fuels, no logs, no big sticks. There's no ladder fuels, just big tall trees with some black on them. You can tell this area has been treated with prescribed fire and ecological thinning. Right now, I'm standing in a field treatment area that helped to protect communities of Pollock Pines, California from the Caldor Fire. During its first week of rapid growth, the Caldor Fire continued to move to the east and north, pushing right to where we're standing and the communities right across the street. This field treatment area provided our firefighters an opportunity to use a specific tactic known as a backfire or a firing operation. A backfire is a careful, planned, and deliberate process by which firefighters deliberately set fire to fuels to slow down a rapidly approaching fire. You can see the firefighters started right here on the edge of this containment line. So they're bringing fire away from the neighborhood and into this field treatment area. It did burn a little hot, but nowhere near as intense as the head of the fire. And when you look up, the crowns of the trees are all still here. This backfire essentially created a buffer of very little burnable material between the active Caldor fire and these communities. It takes professional, well-trained firefighters to engage in a firing operation such as this during a dynamic incident like the Caldor fire. In this case, it was the El Dorado National Forest hotshots. But a key component of that strategy was this field treatment area. This zone, free of most burnable materials, gave those firefighters the opportunity to utilize a tool that may not have been available if this treatment hadn't been completed. Over a week later, the Caldor fire spotted into the Lake Tahoe Basin, really close to where we're standing right now. It first spotted in untreated forests, and firefighters on the ground reported extreme fire lengths over 100 feet tall. As the fire approached the communities and neighborhoods of Myers, California, it first had to cross through the fuel treatment area that we're standing in right now. When a high-intensity wildfire enters a field treatment area, it can significantly reduce the flame length due to the lack of hazardous fuels. That's exactly what happened here. Firefighters on the ground reported a change in flame length from 100 feet outside the field treatment area to 20 feet. This created opportunity, along with bulldozers, to create containment line and directly attack the fire. Not a single home was lost in South Lake Tahoe. You can really see it right here. This field treatment area allowed the flame lengths to come down so our firefighters could build this containment line to protect these homes. In both of the examples we've spoke about today, It was the bravery and professionalism of firefighters on the ground that protected the specific neighborhoods of Pollock Pines and Myers, California. But it was also the fuel treatment areas that provided that opportunity. Thanks for watching.
So I thought it was just important to show that video because we spend a lot of resources in Tahoe on fuels treatment and forestry management. And so it's important to know how that work can help with managing wildfires in the future, because unfortunately the Caldor Fire probably will not be the last wildfire that impacts Tahoe and the surrounding forests. So with that, that concludes my presentation, and I will take any questions from APC members or the public. Thank you.
Thanks, Shannon. That was a great presentation, a really cool video. Very informative. Thank you so much. I have some comments to make, but I'm going to save that. And I want to go to APC members. So please, APC members, questions, comments on what we heard.
Hello?
Hey, Judith. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I can't figure out how to raise my hand.
That's fine.
That was just a wonderful presentation. The only comment I would make is I was taking note of all the different terminology, and we almost need a glossary to help the public understand what went on with that fire. But for a short presentation, that was really very informative. Thanks.
Yep, new acronyms and
right
words and all kinds of things. Yep, I know.
Fire versus the crowns and the surface and the ladder fuel. It was just a lot.
Other APC members?
Hey, this is Kevin Drake. Shannon, great presentation. Thank you. This answered a lot of questions I've been having about what the effects have been exactly and what's going on. My question is really just, can you elaborate on the kind of the longer term monitoring efforts? I'm hoping there's going to be a pretty big focus on understanding where some of the lower intensity burns were and what the soil and vegetation recovery looks like on its own, like areas that aren't being treated, and better understanding kind of it's a good case study here of what a low to moderate intensity burn. I mean, it was obviously still a wildfire, but potentially what positive benefits it could have as well. I mean, kind of an example we could use. So I'm just curious what is in store for monitoring the areas that aren't being treated.
So as part of the BEAR process, the Forest Service does include monitoring. They right now are focusing more on areas where they are doing treatment and how those respond to precipitation events. There is nothing right now specific to areas that are not treated or that burned at a really low severity. But as I had mentioned in one slide where I talked about the different science proposals and what the Tahoe Science Advisory Council has funded to date, there's a ton of interest to understand all aspects of wildfires and this fire and how it impacts resources, specifically water quality. So I'm sure that will be part of the conversation moving forward and using information we gather from this fire to help us respond to fires in the future and how to best mitigate risks post-fire. So I personally am not aware of anything specific to what you pointed to, but I can certainly find out if there's something specific in the works and get back to you.
Kevin, this is John Marshall. I think something else that I know Shannon has touched on in other presentations is the fact that a lot of the type of impacts that you're talking about are not unique to Tahoe. and there's been lots of monitoring of fire activities outside of the basin. And one of the things that the Science Advisory Group is looking at is how can we maximize our dollars by, you know, looking at where monitoring can happen outside of the basin, or we can use information generated from outside the basin. And so I think that also goes to, you know, some of your concerns about, you know, are we actively covering what we need to cover in terms of monitoring to help inform treatments, you know, different impacts of different fires. And just one other comment is, I think in December, you'll be, we'll be bringing to you code amendments that will address a treatment issue, you know, on steep slopes, that you'll see some of this wet-based, cloud-based modeling that really is going to articulate the benefit of getting in and doing these treatments on steep slopes with low-impact mechanized equipment. So I just wanted to touch on those two things.
Mm-hmm. Good points, John. Kevin, do you have more thoughts?
No, it is something that the science community will likely need to pick up and usually does. We learned a lot. We've learned a lot from some of the past fires, and I'm excited to see what comes out of this one, especially given how relatively low intensity it was in the Tahoe Basin.
Yeah, I can just add that we have worked with our sheriff's office and OES to grant access to closed fire areas to researchers from, I want to say, a lot on the Tahoe Science Advisory Council, UNR, Davis, DRI, those types of institutions are setting up research in the fire area. I'm not exactly privy to exactly what it is. I've just been more facilitating their access, but I know folks are entering the lands and planning research studies. Great. Other comments?
Yes, I. This is Eric with Tahoe Douglas. Can you hear me?
Yeah, Eric, go ahead.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. I, too, was unable to raise my hand, but I wanted to point out, obviously, that's a U.S. Forest Service product, and it speaks directly to those public lands. But I think it's important to note that the, you know, the importance of the defensible space and the work that the fire district did on the private lands around there. You know, unfortunately, that's a great video. It shows a lot of good information, but we need to look at it large scale and globally when it comes to this. It really takes the neighborhoods, the communities becoming fire adapted. Fire adapted communities and FireWise programs really make a difference. So the Living with Fire program, the defensible space, all that comes into play. And, you know, the work that TRPA has done with allowing the fire departments to issue the tree cutting permits and reduce some of the fuels right around the homes proper. I guess to answer the one question about the low intensity fire and how that made a difference, a lot can be said in just the soil, where you can see the soil studies and where you know, the high intensity fire actually damaged that soil deep within the different layers, where when it came into the basin, much of that soil is wasn't damaged to those extreme measures, and so we'll see a better recovery, more receptive environment for that recovery. So that's important. And then, you know, we've studied these fires. Fire is not going to be new to this basin. This is something that we are battling. We're going to be battling this always. We're a fire-prone community up here. And, you know, we really need to look at the large-scale treatments, these large-scale fire breaks. And that's what the Tahoe Fire and Fuels team really does as a partner with TRPA and the other agencies around the basin. The Tahoe Fire and Fuels team looks at that large scale. And of course, you guys, I'm sure, aware of the work that's been done with that and the West Shore what's being done on the West Shore. So looking at that and prioritizing that funding to do, I guess, use the right tools to defend the communities. And that's the right tools and techniques. And I think that video does show, you know, the efficacy of what those treatments do for the community. It's so important. We've seen this time after time in the basin. This wasn't the only fire that we've seen this in. The Angora fire had some treatment areas that they were able to kind of steer it around the high school and some other things. You've got the Emerald fire, and those are some of the things that we need to celebrate and also educate the community as to why that's important to do those fuel treatments. And a lot of it is using, they showed a back burn or a firing operation, but that that needs to be done also continuously. We need to introduce fire back into the environment. And so having those prescribed fires and the burning that's going on needs to be done either in pile burns or broadcast burns throughout the basin. So we need to look at that and how we do more of that in a larger scale again. Having the right tools, speaking of tools, I'm going to go ahead and interject something that's a little outside the box here, but I wanted people to hear this. My chief, Chief Scott Lindegren, is working on an initiative to stop these fires when they're small. You've got to get on these fires right away, and any delay in that can have disastrous consequences. So part of that is getting on them. Getting on those fires right away, fast and furious. We've got a terrain issue here at the lake, so one of those tools, or the right tool for the job, is a helicopter. And having a helicopter based in the basin is a very important tool so that we can fight these fires right away and keep them from devastating the communities, and of course, keeping Lake Tahoe pristine and beautiful and keeping it blue. And all that is going to be making those direct attacks. And we saw that with the Tamarack fire and how if you can catch it right away, catch it in its infancy before that fire establishes and becomes established, we can do a lot to protect the basin. So anyways, I know that sounds like a lot of information, and I agree that's a lot of technical information. We're working with the fire pit, the public information team. And that's a group of all the different agencies around the lake to get this information out to the public. So a lot of lessons learned with the Caldor fire, but it didn't start with the Caldor fire. It started many years prior to that. And so we need to celebrate that good work. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Eric. Yeah, you're our expert on APC, I think. So I'm glad you weighed in and made great points. Any other thoughts on that or anything else?
Mr. Chair, it's Jason Drew. There's a lot to unpack here. Certainly, this was a pretty impactful and event within the Tahoe Basin. Shannon, thanks for the presentation. I like that video. I think it's really good. Hopefully, we'll see that out in the public and around a lot. I think there's a lot to be learned from it. As some of you know, I live in Myers. The fire burned extremely close to my house. There was so much that happened during the fire, a much appreciation for those that don't know. I mean, our local fire districts were really the main force that was fighting the fire, in our local neighborhoods. And so a lot of credit goes out to Lake Valley Fire Protection District and Brad. Zelendik, the fire chief, he called on a lot of the local fire districts to come and help. So, the immediate fire response when it got into the Tahoe Basin, we can credit a lot of the effort of our local fire districts in helping to protect so many of the structures here. Obviously, from the video and what Eric mentioned, the fuels reduction work has been a really important factor in why my house and many others are still standing. So you know, there's so much to be learned from what happened during the fire itself that you know, we'll be talking about it for quite some time, and we'll see what happens. And without a doubt, as many of those of you that are involved in restoration, you know that the massive storm events always happen right when you finish a project, right when those projects are the weakest. And that happened with the event that occurred just a couple of weeks ago. And things held up pretty well for the projects that I've been involved with, and I think others have been involved with, considering how much rain we got. But I think we need to plan, you know, within the basin and on the West Slope, that there's going to continue to be impacts on infrastructure from landslides, soil movement, drainage patterns are going to have changed that are going to create local and regional flooding issues. Along with water quality issues. So a lot was learned. A lot of credit goes out to the work that was done during and after the fire. There are a couple things that do stand out to me that I hope we can take and treat as lessons learned moving forward. One of those being if you were out and able to see much of the fire suppression efforts, especially the dozer lines. I would hope moving forward that we're going to be able to make better and informed decisions about where those occur and how they occur. There were a number of really sensitive areas that were pretty devastated by dozer lines that you know, I think had thought been given that dozer line probably could have moved slightly one way or the other to not quite have the impact on the resource, but have the positive impact on the fire. And I think we need to look at those areas. Angora Meadow is a great example. If none of you have been there, very intact meadow, been that way for a really long time. That meadow is basically gone. And it will take quite some time, you know, decades for that meadow to restore to where it was. And those are the kinds of examples that I hope we can take from these events, the good and the bad, and learn from so that we can do it better next time. The other piece was, and as it relates to erosion control, is, you know, in the post-fire restoration efforts, the amount of tracking and sediment that was moved onto local roadways was tremendous. There were dozens of sites where, you know, I witnessed the amount of tracking and sediment movement onto roadways and away from sites in an effort to stabilize those areas, which is needed. But I think one of the things that's important for all of us is, you know, with the amount of effort that's placed on reducing sediment, best management practices, and water quality, I think it's really challenging for the layperson to see that and to know what their projects or their efforts are put through in order to get projects permitted, have those projects inspected. And so I think we have to be really sensitive, even in these post-fire restoration efforts, to those particular topics, because actions speak louder than words. And I think it's really difficult for the message that we're all trying to work and send in protecting resources and protecting water quality when the public and visitors see, you know, the amount of impact that's happening in the restoration efforts post-fire. So those are just a couple of thoughts that rang out to me. I mean, overall, we're a tremendously lucky here in the Lake Tahoe Basin, considering what occurred on the West Slope, the impact of structures. I know I'm really thankful to all the efforts that went in for us to have been able to come back to our house. So major thanks to recognition to those that were, you know, suppressing the fire and fighting the fire, and to all the work that happens afterwards. But, you know, I do hope that we don't miss these opportunities to learn from some of the things that happened both during and after. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Great comments, Jason. I was going to say a few of those things, too. I was going to mention the dozer lines in Angora Meadow, so I'm glad you brought that up.
Mr. Chair, this is Eric again. Thank you. So really great comments, Jason. I definitely appreciate those. I think the understanding that, you know, and obviously want to be sensitive to the BMPs and those type of things. What we really need to look at is, again, at a global scale, at a larger scale, we need to look at establishing real fire breaks in the around our communities, and that they can have those things like best management practices utilized in those, but build those beforehand. The time to, you know, to, I understand the sensitivity of the, you know, the environment, but when we're fighting these fires, we're going to be putting the dozer lines where we can get dozer lines in place. And we've got to stop that fire. So, those are very important. Now we luckily didn't have to use some of those dozer lines, but they were definitely put in place for a reason. Had the weather conditions continued, it might have been a different story. So what I would implore the group to look at and everyone else to think about, especially with TRPA, this is something we need to look at when we're developing these communities or developing stuff around there, that we're putting in these fuel breaks or fire breaks, I would say better, real fire breaks around communities so that we can stop these fires before they enter the communities and we can address those sensitive issues about the environment while they're being placed. But the time to do that certainly is not when you don't have the resources and the fire's bearing down on you. So I think I appreciate your comments. I think it was a heck of a firefight. And again, my hat goes out to the county and Brad Zlindick and for his efforts in fighting that fire with his crews and in coordinating with the rest of the chiefs. So good comments. The other thing too, I think we need to look at is when we're approving homes, you know, now we're doing a much better job of that after the Angora, but that home hardening, you know, that the egress, the fire flows that are available in these communities, all that's important because, you know, the great thing about Christmas Valley is we had water available to us to fight the fire. And, you know, some of that water was out of the box thinking. Some of that water was treated effluent that was used. And they actually used that from the lines and were able to tap into those fire hydrants there to get that water that was needed to fight the fire. So we need to look at those things as well and think out of the box sometimes for these emergencies. Thank you.
Yeah, just a second.
Thanks, Eric. Other comments? Got a good discussion going here. Okay, I was just going to jump in with a couple things. Many of the things I was going to say have already been stated, so I'm not really going to say them again. But just obviously want to state that, you know, this fire affected our county tremendously. You know, almost all 200,000 acres burned in El Dorado County. So it's an absolute, you know, devastation for our county and primarily on the West Slope. We were, you know, as stated, very lucky in the Tahoe Basin and, you know, and we had good fuel treatment and we had water and we had great firefighters and all those things. So it was more than luck, but the weather shift certainly helped us. And the predictions were pretty dire for what could have happened in Tahoe and thank God it didn't. But, you know, on the West Slope, we had, you know, 750 approximately houses burned down and close to 1,000 structures total. So we have a tremendous workload with the communities, you know, in Phillips Track, Strawberry, Grizzly Flats, especially, and many others down on the West Slope that we're working with. And our board's been paying, you know, very close attention to this. We had a dedicated item last week that maybe some of you saw with an update on what's going on. We are applying to FEMA for lots of reimbursement and repair work. We have, you know, lots of infrastructure damage, bridges, culverts, roads, you name it, that we're repairing. We are working with those owners on getting cleanup done with Cal OES and trying to waive fees and passing emergency ordinances for those owners so that they can build, they can begin the rebuild process. Regarding Tahoe, the storms, you know, I think Jason kind of mentioned this, but the big storm a few weeks ago really moved a lot of sediment in the Tahoe Basin. We had whole block channel infrastructure systems that were completely filled with dirt and have been digging out ever since, and have really dug out several hundred cubic yards of dirt out of our BMPs, which are there to convey water and capture sediment. So they're doing their jobs, but really steep slopes and fairly high intensity burn. I was just going to make one note on that. You know, luckily we had low and moderate, severely severe burn in most of Tahoe, but like looking at this picture that's on the slide right here, I think they would call that a moderate burn. And I did a field tour and went up Fountain Place Road, which is, for those that don't live on the South Shore, a Forest Service road that goes up to some of the best recreation that we have in the Tahoe Basin, which is where a lot of the mountain biking and things happen on the South Shore, like the Corral Trail, Connector, Cedar, all those really popular trails. And that area burned tremendously hot. And in most of that area, there's no needles left on the trees, kind of like you can see in this photo. So this is a moderate severity burn, but to the layperson that was standing there, like me, it looks, I would say, high. It's a high severity burn. Hopefully we'll see regeneration and regrowth, but the reality is some of our recreation facilities on the South Shore are destroyed and probably won't be the same in our lifetimes, and hopefully it will be in our kids' lifetimes, but there's a tremendous impact to recreation from this fire that I just wanted to highlight. A lot of those trails are right out near Jason's house, so I know that's a big deal for him. And just to close that thought, we are coordinating. I just do want to highlight the coordination that's gone on with this fire. I mean, it's been tremendous. We have weekly calls with, you know, an incredible amount of agencies. Every acronym I could mention is on these calls, and trying to coordinate and help where they can. And so we're very thankful for that. We've been working with the Forest Service on some debris flow potential and sediment movement that's coming down into our rights of way from their land in the Tahoe Basin. Just a little bit on that, on the graph that Shannon showed on the turbidity spike. You know, hopefully that was the first flush spike, but at 800 CFS with that increase in turbidity, I mean, that is a decent load. Anytime the flow jumps that much with that much of a spike, that's when you do see, you know, fairly significant loading. That said, you know, I think all the experts and the models are predicting that we won't see a huge impact to the lake from this fire. I think it was in, you know, kind of that upper to mid upper watershed area, and there's a lot of treatment down below it to capture sediment. So that is a really good thing for Tahoe, that we're not going to be facing just, you know, absolutely devastated watersheds like we are on the West Slope. And we have watersheds burned all the way from the top to the bottom on the West Slope on like the Steely Fork of the Cosumnes River, for instance, and other fairly big, significant drainages for the state of California. The Cosumnes River, I think, is the last major undammed river in the whole state of California. So it's a pretty cool area, and it's going to be facing some challenges moving forward with the burn severity and the steepness of the slopes down there. I think that's it. I just wanted to share some thoughts. This completely changed our county's workload, and, you know, all of our staff in my department have had to pivot now already with full-time jobs to doing, you know, a tremendous amount of work to try to rebuild these communities and help the owners and play our part to stabilize the watersheds and do everything that we're tasked to do. So just wanted to mention those things. And thank you for your time on that. Do we have any final comments before I open this up to the public?
Mr. Chair, this is Eric again.
Chair.
I guess one other thing that that is a concern, and it's very pertinent to this topic, is, you know, we're talking about the rehab and the rebuild. And I think that we've got to do a better way to reach out to the private homeowners. I know that some of them, you know, and the private land owners, I guess, you know, you got a lot of agencies that are working. You got the U.S. Forest Service, UNR, Davis, and the cooperative extensions from both of those. What the concern is that we're now prone for invasive, and we talk about the invasive species, but the weeds and those type of things. The worst thing we could have is cheatgrass come in and get established, and then we have, you know, this flashy fuel that's there. So I think people are asking what to reseed with and those type of things. And I found out that some of the seed that was available to the public from different folks was actually for the they listed it for the Tahoe Basin, but it had invasive seeds in it. When I talked to the Forest Service, they're like, no, we don't want half these seeds in here. We actually poison those seeds. Those are invasive species. So we really need to tighten our belt a little bit from a TRPA perspective and look at what homeowners and what people can do to help with the rehab process and get ahead of that before we get invasive species introduced into this this area that will be ripe for that. So that's one just call to action I wanted to put out there, and I appreciate it. Great presentation, guys, and I appreciate all your comments.
Thanks, Eric. I think that's a good point. Yeah, we've been talking about invasive, and even coming in on the bulldozers, which came from who knows where. I mean, there's a lot of vectors for invasives. I think, you know, Kevin could probably weigh in on this, but a lot of these areas, you know, owners probably shouldn't be reseeding. It's probably not needed, you know, just trying to stabilize the soil. There's probably a lot of seed that is in the soil already that can survive a fire like that. So unless you know what you're doing, I think the recommendation is probably don't just start throwing seed around. exactly. You know, we've been doing workshops with owners. We have community, you know, we have a couple community representatives, like from Grizzly Flat, again, not Tahoe, but we are trying to do workshops and get information out to owners, but I think that's going to be an ongoing effort, no doubt.
And if I could just add, I think that's a great comment, Eric, and I know it's a really high priority for TRPA overall, is managing terrestrial and aquatic invasives. And I know for you're talking more about private homeowners, but I, on the other side, on the federal and state land, there's definitely one of the priority treatments recommended in the Bear Report was monitoring for invasives and rapidly responding to infestations. So it definitely is on everyone's radar and is a high priority for the areas impacted by fire moving forward. So thank you for that comment.
Yeah, and I guess the concern would be, you know, the Johnny Appleseeds out there. People are wanting the those trails back. They want to do rehab. They want to do those. They just want to take action. You know, it's their they look at it as their playground, and they want to, you know, be stewards of the land as well. But in doing that, they if they don't know what they're doing, that's a real problem. And so, you know, we've seen that. And so they can introduce some stuff that it could be harmful. So I think we better outreach and educate the public in that area, in that arena as well. I think the Forest Service obviously is well dialed, you know, with the Bear Report and everything. But I'm thinking if you have people, I said, Johnny Apple seeding it and going through there, and, you know, that's going to be a real problem for TRPA on this. And then I think it could introduce some light flashy fuels that we don't want in the basin.
Yep. Agreed. Thank you. Any final comments? Okay. Let me then move to public comment on this item. So again, to participate, please go to TRPA.gov, click on Advisory Planning Commission, November 10, 2021. And there you'll find a link to the public webinar. If any member of the public wishes to address the APC at this time, please use the hand-raising function now, and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member. Catherine, over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to comment on this item.
Okay. All right. Well, I will go ahead and close public comment and say thank you again to Shannon for that great presentation. We really appreciate it. And thank you all for weighing in. That was a great discussion on that item. It was just informational, so no action needed. And I'm going to move us along now to item six, which is reports. This is item seven. I'm going to pass this over to Kim Carringer, who's standing in for the executive director report, including the quarterly report and upcoming topics. Hey, Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Kim Carringer. I'm the Environmental Improvement Division Manager here at TRPA and filling in for John Hester. I have a couple things. The Chair Brendan asked that the ED report cover the disposition of the recommendations from the APC. So here's that information. First, the APC made recommendations on the work of the Tahoe Living Working Group on Housing, which you just received that presentation on that today. And as Karen Fink mentioned in her presentation, the GB approved all recommendations except the ADU changes are on hold for the Nevada side until they hear from Douglas County and Washoe County. And then second, the APC recommended that the GB issue the threshold evaluation, and the TRPA governing board did that as well. Third, I will mention John Marshall did reference the upcoming potential code changes for Forest Health on recommending mechanical equipment on steeper slopes above 30%. We'll be bringing that in the future to review and potentially recommend to GB. And also, I believe Dennis Sabaglo gave you all a presentation on the Aquatic Invasive Species Program and the Tahoe Keys Control Methods Test Project. That is up for recommendation at the Lahontan Board in January to certify the EIS and project decision. We'll be bringing that to you as well for a recommendation for certification of that EIS to the governing board sometime in early 2022. So that's all I have, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thanks, Kim. Good update. I will then pass this over to John Marshall for the general counsel status report.
Thank you, Chair. We have today's update is composed of cell towers and shore zone structures. Cell towers, we have two pending pieces of litigation, the Garmong longstanding cell tower case on a cost from Skyland and on the Nevada side. And I believe the last time we talked, we had prevailed in getting the case dismissed at the district court level. And it is now, an appeal has been filed by Mr. Garmong up to the Ninth Circuit. So stay tuned for that long-lasting lawsuit. Then we have the Eisenstecken case that is challenging the now it's actually been approved by the hearings officer, but a cell tower that was approved by the city of South Lake Tahoe off of Ski Run. And that case, the development there is that the hearings officer heard and approved the cell tower, and an administrative appeal has been filed up to the governing board, and then we assume that whatever decision the governing board renders will be subject to litigation after that time. Now on to shore zone structures. First, a big congrats to Ellery and Nevada State Lands. They prevailed in a lawsuit by Tahoe lakefront owners that challenged their permit rates for piers and buoys on state lands. I don't know, Ellery, if the appeal period has run or if you've seen an appeal or what's the status?
We haven't reached that time limit yet, but it is getting close, and we are expecting appeal.
Okay. Steve, you know, I was kind of thinking maybe regional revenue could be tacked on top of rental rates there as another avenue for, anyway. The other case that's just recently been filed is against TRPA by a neighbor of a new single-use pier that was approved. So the neighbor is challenging TRPA's approval of that pier on a number of grounds, including the fact that the pier permit was had some conditions attached to it, which they feel had to happen prior to approval rather than be attached as conditions. Principally, this would have been a finding by the Army Corps that the pier does not constitute a threat to safety and navigation. The condition says you can't build the pier prior to obtaining that negative determination. An interesting claim is that our delegation, this was a peer application that was delegated to the hearings officer and then appealed up to the governing board, that the ability to delegate to staff and the hearings officer is questioned because there is no express delegation abilities within the compact. And so the plaintiffs contend that the governing board must hear all projects. We don't think that claim will be successful, but if it is, then that would have a substantial impact on our permitting abilities within the basin. So that's about it for me. If you have any questions, you can shoot me an email, ask it now, or we can talk. Thank you.
Any questions for John?
The litigious world.
Indeed. Thanks, John. Good update. Okay, now on to APC member reports. I'll go ahead and do a roll call, and if you have anything to report, we'd love to hear it. So I'll start with Garth Alling.
Nothing at this point, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Garth. Sam Booth, I don't think Sam's on. I'll go to Judith Simon.
I have no report.
Thank you. Susan Chandler?
Nothing to report.
Thank you. Kevin Drake?
Nothing this month.
Thanks, Kevin. Jason Drew?
No additional comments, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Drew. Eric Gavon?
Thank you. Just when in regards to the Caldor fire, there's going to be a after action that's being coordinated through Lake Valley, as they were the agency where the fire burned. They're going to hold an after action, and it's not just going to be a whitewash. It's going to be, we want to look at all the good and the bad. And I'll be sure to make sure that we do talk about dozer lines, Jason, as you talked about. That's coming up. There's been some counties have already done some after actions, but really, we had to wait till the fire was, at least fully contained. So they're going to be hosting that. It'll be coming up in the next month or so. So, if interested parties, just let the chief know there. Brad Zlindick. And other than that, moving forward with development in our district, got a chance to walk through the event center the other day, and they're going to be putting steel up and continue to build through the winter months. And we've got a lot of active construction going on. So end of report.
Thank you, Eric. Kevin Hill.
Nothing to report.
Thanks, Kevin. Crystal Jacobson.
Yeah, thank you, Brendan. I have just a few things. One is some good news on the housing front. We were part of a Mountain Housing Council ribbon cutting for some housing that just came online in the North Tahoe region. So we have 288 new units between us and Truckee, Nevada. that are coming online. So super excited to be a part of that. A number of those units are in Placer County, not necessarily in the basin, but here providing, you know, workforce and affordable housing in the region. And then also our board approved an extension of the TARC Connect micro shuttle service. So we're extending that pilot program through winter. It was really, really successful through the summer months. And so it's a free micro shuttle program. So we are extending that into the winter to see how it works through the winter months with providing those connections throughout the region here. And then they also approved the extended approval of free ridership of our TART system for another 2 years. So that was a pilot program, a little impacted by COVID, but we have extended that for another 2 years. And then finally, I just wanted to point out that our board established a moratorium on any new short-term rentals. That was in August, and the moratorium extends through the end of March 2022, and we are currently undertaking a update to our short-term rental ordinance, which may include a cap provision. We're looking at a lot of different kind of limiting or restrictions on short-term rentals, and the cap may be one of those. So some more to come on that as we get closer. We do have a workshop, a board status update and workshop that'll be held on December 14th. At our a board hearing. So that's it for me. Thanks.
Thank you, Crystal. Let's see, Ben is not with us and Heather Ferris is not. How about John Hitchcock?
Nothing to report.
Thanks, John. Ellery?
Hi, thank you. Just one item. Last legislative session, we were successful in having additional bond authority approved for Lake Tahoe EIP. And just last month, the Board of Finance met and approved our request to have a little over $5 million in bonds issued for the EIP. These dollars will be obligated towards Lorewood Creek, which is a water quality project in Washoe County, Spooner Phase 2, so the recreation improvements at the Spooner unit of Lake Tahoe Nevada State Park. Those are the main projects, but then also smaller dollar projects in forest health, sensitive species, and other program areas. So we're excited to see the continued support for EIP through the Nevada Legislature and Executive Office.
We are too. Good news. Thank you. How about Steve Teixeira?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick items. I believe Ms. Carringer will confirm that in the infrastructure bill that's going to be signed, there is another $17 million for AIS-related work in the Tahoe Basin. I think that's correct. Kim, yes?
That is correct, and we are very excited about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge. And I think Senator Feinstein was the lead on that, so she gets a lot of credit, along with others who supported that provision of the vast infrastructure bill. Second, I just wanted to point out, and again, this, you know, Kim can be the takeaway for this because she's our management person today, but it's been quite some time since we've had a Forest Service representative on the Advisory Planning Commission. I think it goes back to Mike LeFabe, who was the Forest Service rep before he retired. And that was back when we were meeting in person and I was still the chair. So I hope that with the new Forest Supervisor coming on before the end of the year, Eric Walker, that agency folks can speak to him about restoring a Forest Service representative on the Advisory Planning Commission. I think there's many good reasons for that. The Caldor fire and those issues certainly just being one. But thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Yep. Let's see. How about Eric Young?
Well, howdy, everyone. It was a lovely meeting today. Thank you, everybody. I'll report that Washoe County continues the implementation of its recently adopted area plan. In addition to the housing study that you just heard about from the Prosperity Center, helps us understand some of the housing issues. There's a pretty significant list of action items, implementation items in our area plan, many of which are around transportation. We just closed the date on an RFQ for a mobility plan for the Washoe County portion of the lake. That would include what our area plan calls a local transit plan and a parking plan combined together. We'll see if we get any hits on that from any of the local consultants, but we're looking forward to continuing the implementation of our area plan around some of these action items in transportation. So that's my report. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. How about Vice Chair Carr?
Nothing at this time. Thank you.
Thanks, Jennifer. All right, last but not least is me. I just have two quick things. One, I want to report our board, in addition to our cap on our vacation home rentals in Tahoe of 900 permits, did adopt ordinance amendments at the end of October that are now in effect, which include a 500-foot buffer around the property line of any legally existing VHR where no other VHRs are to be allowed. So it does not wipe out good standing VHRs that are in place now. In other words, we won't take people's permits away. They will be allowed to renew them as long as they're in good standing. However, when the property is sold or if they lose their permit or do not renew and they're inside of a buffer area, they will not be able to obtain another VHR permit. So it's a pretty aggressive approach and one not seen very regularly really anywhere that I've heard of, but our board did take that action. So that is now in effect. And as you can imagine, we're having some interesting conversations with people wanting to obtain a permit. So I'll leave it at that. The other thing is we are amending our Myers area plan to include accessory dwelling units as an allowable use in two of the districts out in Myers. And that is just to reflect changes to state law and to mirror changes that TRPA has already made and that we've made to our zoning ordinance. So that'll go to our board hopefully in December. I just wanted to mention that. Okay. Thank you all for weighing in. Really appreciate that. I'm going to take us now to public interest comments. So again, members of the public participating in our virtual meeting, please raise your hand now and you'll be unmuted by a TRPA staff member if you'd like to make a comment. Just a reminder that the Advisory Planning Commission is prohibited by law from taking immediate action on or discussing issues raised by the public that are not listed on the agenda. Over to you, Catherine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are no hands raised to make a comment on this item.
Okay. With that, I'll take us to our last item, which is to adjourn. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
As much as it was nice to see all of you, I'll go ahead and say I move to adjourn.
I'll second it.
Thanks, Eric. All in favor, please say aye.
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 I'm assuming no one opposes, so we stand adjourned. It's 11:34. Again, thank you all for your participation. Have a great Thanksgiving, and we will see you in December.